Hi, this is Steve Poore, and you're listening to Pioneers and Pathfinders. Our guest today is Stephen Embry, a legal tech guru and longtime lawyer. Among Stephen's many endeavors, one is Tech Law Crossroads, a blog devoted to the practical impact of technology and innovation on law practice. He writes frequently on the clash of cultures between tech and innovation on the one hand and traditional precedent-grounded legal profession on the other. Today, he is a national litigator and advisor, primarily in the mass tort, business and consumer class action, and privacy and data breach arenas. Additionally, Stephen is past chair of the ABA's Law Practice Division and the past chair of the Data Breach, Privacy and Cyber Insurance Section of the Federation of Defense and Corporate Counsel. Stephen has also co-authored the book Mass Tort Claims Resolution Facilities, as well as the 2020, 2017, and 2016 editions of the ABA's Legal Technology Survey Reports. In our discussion, Stephen discusses why he started blogging, the disconnect between lawyers and legal tech vendors, pro se litigants using generative AI, and reconsidering pricing structures with the rise of generative AI. Thank you for listening in. Stephen, thank you for joining. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'm glad to be here. Looking forward to it. I'm a big fan, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you. Where am I catching you? In Kentucky?
I am in Louisville, Kentucky. Exactly right. Yep.
Well, I promise as a graduate of Indiana University, if you promise not to talk about the terrible state of Indiana athletics, I promise not to talk about Kentucky.
That's a deal.
Yeah. So in your current incarnation, you're a blogger, you're a publisher at Tech Law Crossroads, right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about Tech Law Crossroads. What is it? Where do people find it? And what's the mission of the blog?
Sure. You know, I practiced law for a good number of years, more than I like to admit sometimes. And I wasn't particularly unhappy practicing law. I was just looking to do something different. So I started a blog. Actually, I started writing on LinkedIn, mainly about technology and innovation. And from that, I ended up starting the blog, Tech Law Crossroads, which you can find by typing in Tech Law Crossroads in search.
We'll put a link in the show notes for you as well.
Okay. And, you know, I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed sort of sharing my perspective on things as a practicing lawyer or former practicing lawyer. And as I began doing it more and more, I liked it more and more. And I was a mass tort defense lawyer at the time, an Am Law 200 firm. It may even be an Am Law 100 firm now, since I'm not there anymore. But in many respects.
Frost Brown, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great firm.
In many respects, you know, doing that kind of work is a little bit feast and famine. You can only have, you know, two or three of those projects going at one time and keep your head above water. And then if two or three of them in, you kind of hit a lull. And I was in a bit of a lull and was liking doing the blog and sort of one day said to myself, why don't I just do this? Why don't I just write the blog? So that's what I decided to do. And I've been happy doing it. I'm not one of those people that goes around saying I'm a recovering lawyer like it was, you know, a bad part of my life. It wasn't. I enjoyed practicing law. I was proud to be a lawyer and left happily. But it was, you know, time to do something else. And I've enjoyed every minute of it.
What drove you to be a lawyer in the first place?
You know, it's an interesting question. And there's a Steve Jobs quote that I think is appropriate to a lot of these kinds of things. And that is you can't really connect the dots until you look backward. But
it's a great quote, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And it's really true. Looking back on things, I think I enjoyed looking at rules, the set of rules, and figuring out how to devise solutions within those rules to problems, to issues, either maximizing the use of the rules or finding areas that the rules didn't cover that would allow you to do things. And that sort of lent itself to law school and being a lawyer. I don't think I consciously had that kind of notion in my head. I think I enjoyed looking at problems and looking at rules and how to deal with them. And, you know, just that gravitated me toward the practice of law. That plus the fact that I was terrible at math and science, so, you know, what the hell else you gonna do?
Now that sounds very familiar to me. I sure wasn't going to be a doctor, that's for sure.
Right.
Did you practice for a long time?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Where does the interest in technology come from?
You know, it's an interesting story. So when I first got out of law school, I went to work for a large firm at that time and was immediately thrown into handling a large number of administrative cases that were tried in front of ALJs, administrative law judges. And it was, talking about being thrown in before you're ready, it was a ton of work, a lot of correspondence, a lot of letters and pleadings and that kind of thing. And I was barely keeping my head above water. And my secretary, and they were called secretaries then, came in one day and she said, you know, I've been noticing what you've been doing and what you have to do. And she said, why don't we create some form documents that all you have to do is look at what's said in the form and then either add something or take something out. That would save you a whole lot of time. And it didn't take me too long to figure out that she was really right. And so I piqued my interest into work processes and automation and workflows and how to get work done quickly or faster, just as well as a slower way. So I was always interested in that kind of thing, which led me to technology. But the critical thing that finally got me interested in technology was I was working late at night on a brief in the office, wishing I was home and seeing my kids. And I happened to pick up an American Law Media magazine. In those days, it came in the big glossy thing. And there was an article about Fred Bartlett of Bartlett and Beck. And I will never forget the quote. He was asked what he was doing. And he said, I'm sitting in my condo in the Rocky Mountains finishing a brief. And I read that and I looked at my pile of paper on my desk and I thought, you know, this guy's onto something.
Fred's onto a lot of things.
So that led me into an interest in technology. And it also led me to an understanding that I could practice law from anywhere, which for a lawyer doing mass tort work in Louisville, Kentucky, that was an important realization because almost all of my cases over my career were in places other than Louisville. So being able to work in a place away from an office, being able to work from anywhere using technology was very appealing and enabled me to do a lot of things that I probably wouldn't have done had I not gone down that path, had I not read that article about Fred Bartlett.
Serendipity.
Right. Can't connect the dots looking forward. You have to look at them backward.
Well, looking backwards, let's stick with that theme for a moment, because we're in a world of generative AI where the world is going to change dramatically and lawyers are resistant and all that. And you wrote a blog post on that I want to talk about here in a second. But as you look backwards, you're talking about the impact of technology on the profession. And I think that, and I'm curious as to your reaction, because you and I are of similar vintage. So we've lived through word processing and technology-assisted review and e-discovery and all of these things that were going to eliminate the profession or the lawyers were never going to use. What do we learn from these past adoptions of technology that may be applicable in this current wave of mania?
Well, that's an interesting question. Part of the problem, I think, has been many of those things were overhyped. Not like generative AI, huh?
not possible hype at that level.
But lawyers are, number one, they have a low tolerance for BS, as you know. I mean, that's often what we do as lawyers is BS a lot, but we see it pretty quickly. And they're inherently skeptical. And so all of these things would trot out that were supposedly the thing to revolutionize the way we practice law and change the way we work and all of that. And most of them didn't pan out. Now, having said that, particularly with trial lawyers, at the good trial lawyers, you have to adopt the technology that lets you talk to juries and judges, persuade them. We are in the communication business, the persuasion business. That's what we do. And that would lead you to say, okay, what are the tools you have to use that people expect? How do they expect to learn? Which brings you to technology. I teach a class, a 2.5-day workshop every year, trying to teach trial lawyers to better use technology in the courtroom or in persuasion in general. And the thing that's very interesting about that is these lawyers will come in, many of which, I mean, they're taking the course because they feel like they're behind, obviously. So they come in feeling behind and overwhelmed sometimes, and they leave almost to a person. They leave with a new lease on life. They get it very quickly and they understand it very quickly. We actually ask them to use the tools for a day and a half and then stand up and give whatever they want, an opening statement, closing statement, mediation statement, using some of the tools. And it's remarkable how quickly they get it. And so that suggests to me, at least for good lawyers, that they're open to technology. They understand the need to use technology when it's appropriate and when it's helpful. They don't necessarily leap, they're not necessarily early adopters for a whole lot of reasons, not the least of which is those pesky things called ethics and client confidentiality and all of that get in the way occasionally.
All those pesky things, yeah.
Right. So they have to be cautious, but I don't see, you know, there's a sort of this universal slam on lawyers that we're curmudgeons, that we don't like technology, that we don't use it, that we're too slow to adopt, that we, you know, all the bad things you hear. There's a grain of truth in that, but there's also part of the reason for that is we have to do certain things to protect our clients. Part of the reason for that is, you know, unlike doctors, for example, in the medical fields where you have certain standards by which new products have to be evaluated before they go on the market. You know, the FTC has certain standards, for example. So when a drug is released, there's some feeling and some legitimate belief that it will sort of do what it's supposed to do. We don't really have that in law, right? I mean, we'd have no body out there stamping this generative AI tool is a good one and you can use it. And so what we're left with, in order to satisfy our ethical obligations, we have to vet a lot of these technology products ourselves. And for a profession, particularly for those in the profession that bill by the hour, that's a real problem. We don't have time to investigate a lot of these products and decide whether they're really going to work appropriately before we buy them. And so we then tend to rely, at least in large firms, on IT people to do that. And they're very well-meaning and all of that, but sometimes they don't get the need for us to be able to quickly and intuitively grasp a piece of technology and use it in the way that helps us. So there's a little bit of this disconnect that goes on. And historically, there's been a disconnect, I think, between legal tech vendors and how lawyers practice, at least the billable hour lawyers. I used to go to tech shows and would walk from booth to booth and, you know, they would say, let me demo this product for you. And they would, you know, you say, click here, and then you go here and click there, and then you go here and click there. And I was, three clicks is it, and that's all you get. I'm sorry. We're not going to click more than three times to get where we want to go. You better come up with something a little better than that, a little easier than that. I think that's changing quite a bit, but, you know, there's still some of that out there. So, you know, the thing I think we learned from all of this is ease of use, intuitive use, and meeting lawyers kind of where they are with their needs and what they need to do to practice effectively and easily.
You wrote about that disconnect recently in a blog that I thought was very interesting as you were doing the circuit of tech week and tech shows and at the same time practicing lawyer. How do you see that disconnect manifesting itself in a world of generative AI, given the astounding level of hype?
Well, the problem, I think, is, number one, this sounds like blockchain all over again, if you will.
It does sound like blockchain, although I have to admit, I can see use cases for generative AI, and it was always difficult to see the use case for blockchain as a general proposition in the profession.
That's right. And so you have lawyers coming in that are skeptical, and we tend to look for the worst, right? I mean, that's kind of our nature. And so the worst that what we hear is, well, these generative AI tools make stuff up. They hallucinate. They're not accurate. They don't protect client confidences. Nobody understands how they work, which is partly true. What they haven't grasped yet is the tremendous power of these generative AI tools. And therein, I think, lies the hope for the future. These tools are different, as you well know, because they are conversational and you can talk to them. You don't have to do a Boolean search. I never mastered a Boolean search. I had to go ask the chief nerd in the office to do the Boolean search, right? But these are different. I think once we get our heads around that difference, once we get our heads around that ability, I think there's going to be a lot of adoption across the industry.
No, it's interesting. You're reminding me of a post I saw, and perhaps you saw it. The in-house general counsel for Carlton Fields wrote a blog post about why that firm will never use generative AI. And it sort of played right into the point you're making, where the resistance to change is because of all of these problems, and they are legitimate issues, no question about it, becomes overwhelming. But the conversational nature of this technology, it's like putting your finger in a dike, it seems to me. People are going to use it.
There was a very interesting article in the New York Times, maybe yesterday. It wasn't directed at generative AI and legal, but it was talking about some of the skills that you will need to effectively use generative AI. And one of the skills they identified was the ability to communicate effectively as a human being, with a human being. And, you know, it dawned on me, I was reading this, is who are some of the best communicators in the world? It's us. It's lawyers. I mean, that's what we do. As I said before, that's what we're in the business of, which makes me think that once lawyers get it, they're going to pick up this technology and run. Now, there are certain hurdles, you know, including the confidentiality and the ethical sort of requirements that need to be addressed. And by that, I mean, we need to know as lawyers the ethical limits of using some of the. For example, with technology-assisted review, there's a certain level of errors that are tolerated, and that's okay. With email, there's still a certain risk that you send a client communication via email. There's a certain risk that somebody could take it, just as there is somebody could steal the letter out of the mailbox. Those risks are tolerated, and that toleration is sanctioned by ethical opinions. We haven't yet reached that point with the generative AI technology, but as that develops, and I think it will, then, you know, lawyers will say, well, okay, maybe it is safe. Maybe it's okay. Maybe the risks are so low that this confidentiality we breached, I'll feel more comfortable using it. Now, as you and I both know, you don't have to plug in your client confidences to use this, right? As a trial lawyer, for example, you might want to say, here's a brief by my opposing counsel. What are some logical fallacies in this brief that I can attack? That's not a client confidence. So there are any number of uses, but yet it's fear that sort of stands out right now that any use could be a problem. But I think we'll get there. I mean, I think as those standards sort of develop and lawyers see it's okay to use it, it'll be like email. I mean, it's ubiquitous. So,
what is the role of the bar associations in developing ethical standards for these technologies? You sort of hit on a little bit more, but let's flesh that out a little bit more.
The ABA still generates ethical opinions and ethical standards, and those are looked to by states, state bar associations. I think it is incumbent upon the bar associations to develop those ethical sort of opinions. I would much rather the bar associations do that than individual judges come up with prohibitions or requirements or what have you. I think that's just a disastrous way to try to deal with technology, because a lot of what they say is wrong and they don't have any better understanding than anybody else. And you get this mismatch of judge in this jurisdiction says this and that jurisdiction says that. And I would much rather see a bar association involvement. I know in our state, in Kentucky, we have a committee that's looking at the issue and how to deal with it across the board as a bar association. I know Florida, for example, has done that. California has done that. I think others are in the process of doing that, which is a legitimate way, a legitimate role for those associations.
Yeah, you know, you make an interesting point about the vacuum leading individual judges to take particular roles. You saw a lot of that happening after the New York case got all the publicity. And the reaction of the judges was understandable, but I think they were difficult to sustain given the evolution of the technology.
Right. Well, and they fed upon this fear by lawyers of using the technology. You read some of these opinions where the judge is saying, if you use generative AI or even AI, which was kind of on the silly side of things, but if you use generative AI, you have to tell me that you've used it and certify you've read all the cases. And as a practicing lawyer, if I was in front of a judge and saw that kind of order, I wouldn't use the tool, right? Because the very order itself suggests the judge will be skeptical of my arguments if I put that certification in there. And as trial lawyers, and this is probably true of all lawyers, I mean, that in order to persuade effectively, we have to be credible, and that means we have to be accurate. And anything that affects our credibility and the accuracy of what we're saying is a problem. So when you see these judges' orders like that, a lot of lawyers, perceptive lawyers, will say, I'm not going to touch this stuff because it will disadvantage my client. It will disadvantage my argument in front of this judge. And that's unfortunate, I think. And it's also unfortunate when you start talking about pro se litigants and what they may or may not have to do, because they don't have the kind of tools that lawyers have to do research. But now they have something that might help. And yet we want to keep them. We seem to have this attitude in some jurisdictions. We want to keep them from using it. So keep them down on the farm, I guess. I don't know. It's really disheartening to see that.
It is. The access to justice implications are, I think, incredible here, in that it gives people a powerful tool to represent themselves and to know their rights. The challenge to it is, how do those people know when it's hallucinating? How do they know when it's wrong? Because it's not right 100% of the time. And that sort of goes to your point about what tolerance are we going to have for errors in this tool?
Yeah, and it's a particular problem with state judges. You know, federal judges, they have law clerks. They have some resources. Now, you know, a lot of them would say, well, I don't have enough. But, you know, that's like when you're
They've got more than state court judges.
Yeah. It's like when you're on a nonprofit, you know, there's never enough money, no matter how many donations you've got. But they have the ability, if you have clerks and you recognize it's a pro se litigant, you have the ability to do some checking, and probably an obligation, you know, as a judge to do some checking, not to penalize them necessarily for using this tool, but to make sure it is accurate. That's different than an obligation of a lawyer and a responsibility of a lawyer. I mean, a lawyer knows that he or she needs to check accuracies of any citations, but pro ses don't. So I think it's okay for pro se litigants to be able to use these tools, even if they're not always accurate, because if they're 75% accurate, that's 75% more than what pro se litigants had before, right? So let's not throw the baby out with the wash. The worry, of course, is that when you get into state court and courts don't have the resources to deal with what could be a wave of pro se litigants using these tools. And I also would note they don't have the resources to deal with the deep fake problem, which I think is going to be a tremendous problem in the courtroom in the future. But, you know, I think whenever you talk about these kinds of tools and accuracy and all of that, you have to say, well, you know, how does that compare with what we had before the tools and what was available to people before we had the tools? And we also have to face the fact that these tools are more inaccurate as of today than they will ever be, because they're going to get better and they're going to begin to be more accurate and have fewer hallucinations. I mean, you had this happen as many times as I did. In writing a brief, you read a citation from the other lawyer and you go read the case and it doesn't seem to really quite say that.
How did they get that interpretation? Absolutely.
Right. And, you know, I mean, you and I are old enough to remember using Westlaw headnotes. And, you know, I learned very quickly, you can't just rely on the head note. You better go read the case, because, you know, Westlaw does pretty good. They're not always 100% accurate either, even in the old days. So,
yeah, you know, it's interesting. This has been the history of technology. We hold technology up to being perfect. Oh, it made a mistake. Therefore, we're not going to use this particular tool, whether it's technology assisted review or computer assisted research or whatever. And that's the wrong standard, because humans make mistakes as well. Your point about the Westlaw headnotes is apt. Back in the day, humans did that.
Right.
And people are not always perfect either. We're looking at the wrong standards.
Yeah, you know, and the whole concept of the ethical standard And much of our law, you know, it's based upon what's reasonable, which is to your point. I mean, we have to expect some level of error in everything. And that's why we have a reasonable standard, not a perfect standard, because it couldn't be a perfect standard.
I'm curious, we've talked about tools. You've just made the circuits of a variety of tech shows. Anything stand out for you as something that was an interesting or surprising use case or development of the technology that you think is?
Well, you know, that's a great question. So I, it would be easy for me to say, oh, all these generative AI tools are really something. But I've got two use cases that are not totally generative AI tools. And both of them come from the winner and runner-up of our Startup Alley at Tech Show. The winner has created a tool by which you can develop alternative fees based upon timing and value and previous time spent. And it's a really interesting tool. And I think I can't vouch for how well it's going to work because, you know, I don't practice full time anymore. But the concept is fascinating because as generative AI tools mature, we are going to see them. They're going to have to be priced differently than billing by the hour, I think, because our leverage model has always been based on the billable hour, and a lot of us made a lot of money that way. And that model is not going to work when you've got a generative AI tool that can do a lot of the lower end work in the pyramid for next to nothing, if you will. So being
let me push on that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's not going to work for private practitioners or used to billing by the hour, but will it still work for the buyers of legal services who will be expecting less human time, less involvement by people to lower their cost?
Right. Yes, it will. And I think what I think will inevitably happen is that we are going to have to shift from a time standard to a value standard. You know, what is the value of me as a lawyer doing this case and using these tools? Because if I price that on a time matter, then it's I'm not going to make any money. And I'm not going to say, I don't mean to say that we need to all make millions of dollars, but I mean, this is how we make our living, right? I mean,
right.
We are in it to make money and be profitable. And we may not be able to be as profitable as we once were if we were billing strictly by the hour. But you know, when you shift to value, I had a case years ago in, it was a big, huge fire case in Philadelphia. And I had to get a local counsel and I picked a firm, and the two lawyers in the firm, a younger lawyer and a senior partner, and the senior partner's rate was extraordinarily high. And my client, you know, screamed, you know, why are we paying David that kind of money? I mean, we don't pay anybody that kind of money, blah, 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 blah. And I said, you know, this is a multi-million, if not billion-dollar case. And because this lawyer was so well connected in the city of Philadelphia with the judiciary and with the lawyers in the case, the lawyers on the other side, I said, there will come a time in this case where that lawyer will probably spend an hour, but it will be the most valuable hour in the case because of his connections locally and in the city. That's a value-based approach. And I think that's kind of where we will begin to go to as these tools eliminate part of the pyramid. And that's why this alt fee application kind of caught my eye, because, you know, one of the things that they put a premium on is time. So if I come to you and say, Stephen, I need this case filed and it's got to be filed. The statute's running in 2 days. Can you get a complaint up tomorrow? Well, if you're pricing it on value, you say, yeah, but that's going to cost you more than if you'd come in 2 weeks ago, you know, where I had the time. You know, in order to do it by tomorrow, I've got to set aside a lot of other things I'm doing. It's going to cost more because it's a higher value. And I think that's the kind of attitude we're going to see. And we're going to see it from a costing standpoint, too. You know, a lot of times when people do alternative fees now, they basically sit down and they say, okay, let's see, that would probably take me 100 hours to get that done. Just to be on the safe side, I'll pull in another 20 hours. That's 120 hours. I'll multiply that by my rate. And that's the alternative fee. So, but I think what we may see is instead of going strictly by that, right, we'll sit down as a firm and we'd say, okay, what does Embry cost us right now in terms of compensation, office space, overhead? Now we've got a cost number for him. Now we can start building from that into the value of what the work is going to be, how we're, and what our profit margins are going to be, things that other businesses like, you know, have done forever.
Right. Right. The way the consultants never, do it.
Right. It's never dawned on us that we don't need this stuff. And the whole alternative fee thing is fascinating, and it leads, I think, to better service. In the early 90s, I was national counsel for an insurance carrier on a whole series of cases across the country. And the fees were, you know, the hourly fees were getting pretty exorbitant. And, you know, the client was like, what can we do? And how I came up with this idea at the time, it was not popular at the time. I said, well, we'll just do it on a flat fee for a year or 2 years. And I had a pretty forward-thinking general counsel I was working with at the time. And, you know, we went back and forth. We put some collars on it, and, you know, we put some safety guardrails in it and all that other things. And we did it. Once I started working on the case on that basis, on a flat fee basis, I began to see, you know, every one of these cases, almost all of them are settled. Most of them are settled in mediation. If I can come up with a way to get to mediation quicker, we'll get the cases settled quicker, which means the client will be happier and I'll make more money. And I'm not sure I would have ever seen that solution in the way I saw it without changing the way I was pricing the case and billing the case. It just opened up a new view of the world that enabled me to get to the result faster, which is what the client wanted and what I wanted. So,
yeah, I heard someone say, and I know this will be the last point because I know we've run over and I appreciate your time, but I heard someone say that recently that there are two questions as a buyer you ought to ask the law firm when they're proposing an alternative fee. One, will you be handling the case the same way as you've always handled it? And two, will you make as much profit? If the answer isn't no to the first question and yes to the second question, you shouldn't do it.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
You don't want them to lose money, but you want them to think about doing it a different way, just the way you described.
Right. You know, it's interesting, you know, people like us that we've spent most of our careers in large firms, we tend to view the legal market as large firm billable hour kind of matrix. But there's all these different business models that run throughout the legal market. Plaintiff's lawyers, billing on a contingency. I mean, we're not even talking, that's your proverbial apples and oranges, right? I
mean, absolutely.
Totally. And then you have the smaller firms and the solos and how they do business and what they're looking at in it. And so it's very hard to sort of say generative AI is going to revolutionize the legal marketplace. It will definitely revolutionize pieces of it. But I mean, we still have lawyers, as you know, that don't use computers at all in their practice, and they survive. So
they survive. I'm not sure how, but they do.
I'm not sure, but they do. And they do it on relationships and not knowing the locale and the judges, all those kind of things that are important, and on their abilities, you know, their natural sort of abilities. But, you know, I think anytime you get into this area, we shouldn't make general statements about what a technology will do to the legal market, because the legal market is a segmented market in so many ways. You can't even compare it even to the medical field or anything like that. It's just, there's just too many different models and ways of doing things. So yeah, generative AI was going to revolutionize pieces of the legal market, but I'm not sure how it'll revolutionize the entire market like some people think.
Well, it's going to be interesting to watch. Stephen, thank you so much for your time. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Well, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it. And I look forward to hopefully meeting you in person someday and having some more discussions. It's a fascinating topic.
Thanks for listening to Pioneers and Pathfinders. Be sure to visit thepioneerpodcast.com for show notes and more episodes. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform.